We're doing three classic famous tshuvas this week on the topic of Zechuyos HaYotzrim, the Amudei Esh, the Nodi Bihuda, and the Divrei Malkiel. Everyone's asking who the Amudei Esh is, and I've said I don't know exactly who he was other than his name, as Rav Avram Shmuel of Rassien, Nodi Bihuda, everyone knows. Divrei Malkiel is Rav Malkiel Tenenbaum, very distinguished posek, particularly in Chosh and Mishpat from the late 19th, early 20th century. These three tshuvas share three things in common. These are among my favorite tshuvas on the topic. They share three things in common. First of all, they all discuss pretty detailed, colorful, actual cases.
Literally in one case.
Colorful, yes, right. Dyeing, either textile dyeing or painting or something of that sort. B, they're all fairly closely argued, detailed, carefully and rigorously argued tshuvas. Many of the tshuvas in this topic are kind of jumping from point to point, a mixture of all kinds of different things. These are three fairly focused and fairly carefully argued tshuvas. And C, they're all dealing with one, or really two specific models, two specific theories for intellectual property. They approach it from different perspectives, but they're all dealing with the, as we mentioned in our introduction to this topic, there are four or five different approaches the post can take. Last week we discussed the idea of the Shalom Eishev and others that there is a fundamental right to property, to an invention, to an idea that one innovates. These three acronyms are discussing a different approach to intellectual property, and that is the joint approaches of Nehene and Shutfus. So I want to just give a little background on these two ideas, what they are in Chosh and Mishpat, and discuss how they are extended and applied to these cases by the poskim. So first of all, Nehene is one of the most important, although not always well understood, topics in Chosh and Mishpat. We all know the idea of mazik. Mazik is if Reuven breaks Shimon's jar, then Reuven is mazik, Reuven is chayev. Nehene is another theory of liability, which often overlaps with mazik. If I take your cupcake and I eat it without your permission, I am a mazik, yes, and I pay you for the damage to the cupcake. But I'm also a nene. I enjoyed your cupcake. It filled me up. It was tasty. That's called nene. Now, if I ate the cupcake, typically both apply, both mazik and nene. There are cases, however, where mazik does not apply and nene does apply. So the two classic cases in the Gemara, for example, one is if my behemoth goes and eats your food. So in certain cases, that's called mazik. That's Shane, Regel, Karen, different cases. So in many cases, that's going to be mazik, mamana mazik. But there are also cases where mazik doesn't apply. Shane versus Harabim, different reasons why the mazik might not apply. In those cases, what I'm left with is nana. My behema had food. I don't necessarily care if my behema is happy and in a good mood, but at least my behema is fed. It saves me the cost of feeding it. That's nana. Another example the Gemara brings is if a person's father borrows a cow, and then the father dies, he leaves the cow to his heirs, his children. The children don't realize that it's borrowed, it's not their father's, so they eat it. And then the owner comes knocking on their door and says, "You ate my cow, pay me for it." So they're not considered a mazik. Balatos is explained because it's not their fault at all. Mazik ba'onis is pater, even though ademod la'olam, not an onis gomer. Other explanations of the Rishonim, but it's clear that they're not a mazik. What they are, they're classified as nen. They had food, they enjoyed the meal, they were well fed. So you don't actually pay the full value, you pay two-thirds. That's how much the Gemara says is the default, the standard rate of nen, two-thirds of the full value. These are examples of the Talmudic doctrine of nen. I'm not actually a mazik for various reasons, either because I'm an onus or because it was mamana mazik and doesn't always apply. You can have a lot of reasons. It's indirect, it's grama. You can have all kinds of reasons why the principle of mazik doesn't apply, but if you benefited, then there is a chiyuv of nen. So these poskim, Nodi Bihuda, Amudei Esh, Divrei Malkiel, try to apply the doctrine of nen to intellectual property. They try to argue that the infringer, the person who benefited from the other person's work, effort, actual item he stole and used, copied without permission, they try to argue that he is a nen. The other doctrine they discuss is a doctrine of shutfus. Shutfus simply means partnership, and regular shutfus just is two partners get together and now we have to decide how to balance their rights, how to work out details of the partnership. That's what most of Shutfus is. But there's another doctrine of Shutfus, another aspect of Shutfus, which is that if two people need something, two people are in a situation where they both need the same thing. It's a joint effort. Once it's done, it'll help all of them. Each one would hope the other guy pays for it and he freeloads off the first guy. So there's a doctrine in various Gemaras that can't do that. If they all need it equally, they are all equally responsible. The main makar for this, there are two Gemaras. One is in the first parak in Bava Basra. The Mishnah says, Kofenoso livnos beishar delas l'chatzer. Residents of an alley or a chatzer can force each other to build certain structures which are assumed to be necessary for everyone. A guardhouse, doors, gates, kofenoso livnos le'er for the city, choma, walls, mosayim, gates, doors, briach, bars. And the Gemara goes on, and this is taken as a model by all the poskim that each person in the city needs a gate. Now, obviously, it would be nice for me if you spent the money on the gate and I happened to benefit from it. And you probably feel the same way about me. It'd be nice if I did it and you benefited. So this is a chiddush of the Gemara, the way, as understood by basically all the poskim, that there's an idea of shutfus that anyone can tell the other one, you have to pay your fair share. You can't just say you're more relaxed and you know I'm more antsy, I'm going to go do it and then you'll benefit. As long as it's something that inarguably we all need, if it's something that you can say you don't really need it, that's a different story. But something which Chazal established or that Basin thinks that everyone really needs and you're just playing games by saying, I'll wait for you to do it, we know you really need it, this is the doctrine of Shutfus. There's a similar idea which seems to be in a Gemara Bava Metzia. The Gemara Bava Metzia is discussing two cases. One, a river which irrigates fields, and five of us have fields, one upstream, next, down, five in a row from upstream to downstream. And there's a block in the river, so the river has to be cleared. That costs money, time and money. So who has to pay for it? So the basic rule is a very common sense and intuitive rule that whoever is downstream of the blockage and therefore needs to have the blockage cleared have to contribute. So if the blockage is halfway through, so numbers 3, 4, and 5, or 4 and 5 have to clear it. Numbers 1 and 2 who are upstream from that, they don't care if there's a block. It's better for them. If the water is backing up, they have enough water. They're getting extra water. So they don't need the block cleared. They're not responsible for clearing the blockage. So whoever is downstream of the blockage and benefits from having it removed must contribute. And the cost is divided equally among all of the members who are downstream and will benefit. The reverse applies in the case of a sewer line. A river or a sewer, a manufactured sewer that takes away, so less takes away garbage from the people's houses. So if that gets blocked up, then everyone upstream of the block has a problem because their sewer is backing up into their houses, their toilets, and is causing them problems. Everyone downstream doesn't care. There the rule is, same rule as Fakert. Everyone upstream of the blockage who needs to have that blockage cleared is responsible, and the total cost is divided among everyone who lives upstream of the block. A friend of mine back in Lakewood once had this case, Halacha Lemaisa. He was one of about a dozen people or so who built a development. They each built a house in some isolated neighborhood, and they had to bring in infrastructure, sewer lines, electric lines. So I don't know how this is normally done, but at one point there was a question of bringing in a line, and the question was who's going to pay for how much of it, and this was a textbook example of this. The part of the line that ran into the development, everyone paid for. The individual extensions, how far it went, each person would, al pi halacha, unless there's a minhag otherwise or some kind of contractual arrangement otherwise, each person would have to pay would have to contribute a proportional share to the part of the line that was going to his house. Whatever continued past his house, even if the trunk continued, even though it's a trunk, he doesn't have to pay for it because once it gets past him, he doesn't need it. That would be a textbook example of this Gemara. Now, just to discuss briefly now several of the issues the post can run into trying to apply these models to the cases of intellectual property. In the sugya of Nana, the one big exception, which many of you are probably familiar with, is the idea of Zenen of Zela Chaser. This is an extensive Gemara in Bava Kamma, the second parak. The Gemara discusses if I'm Nana, but you are not Chaser. The examples we gave before were cases where my animal or I myself ate your food, so I'm Nana and you're Chaser. You lost. Corresponding to what I gained, you lost. In a case where I'm Nana, but you are not Chaser, you had an empty apartment that wasn't being used anyway, and I live there, so I may have gained tremendously, but you haven't lost anything. That's an extensive sugya in Bava Kamma. Maskana the Gemara, as understood by the poskim, is that you are Potter. If there's no Chaser, then you're not chayev. So the poskim have debated in these cases of intellectual property, even if we call this nana, we have to find a chaser too. We have to show that the owner, the originator, the inventor, the author somehow is chaser. The most obvious chaser, as we mentioned earlier, most of the discussions in the poskim, including all these we're discussing this week, are dealing with commercial infringement. So the most obvious chaser is competition. I'm taking away sales from you. So that indeed, you know, the Behuda and the different Malkiel both consider that to be chaser. The Amudeish is not sure. I actually stopped the primary citations right before he gets into that discussion, but if anyone who has time to read the rest of the tshuva, that's what he goes back and forth and back and forth on. Is this called chaser? He says all the cases of chaser in the Gemara are much more direct. The chaser, one example of chaser is shacharisa da'ashaisa, I get some dirt on your walls. So the chaser is what I did through my hana, I blackened the object I'm being nana from. Here he says the chaser is much more indirect. The thing I took, the case of the Mudeish, was a manual, a book of dyeing, textile dyeing, or some other kind of painting procedures. So the book is not damaged, he says, assuming the book is intact, you don't damage it. What's damaged, if you consider the primary damage, which is the damage to my business, that's very indirect. That's far removed from the source of the property. Is that close enough to be called chaser? So that's really his question. He goes back and forth, and at the end of his tshuva, he's not really convinced. But again, both the Divrei Malkiel and the Nodeb Yehuda both take for granted that that's a perfectly valid form of chaser. They propose certain other forms of chaser also in the tshuvas, as you'll see. Another issue they discuss is even before we really get to chaser, even discussing the basic definition of nana itself. Am I really considered nana from you in these cases? So the Amud Eish is the simplest case. I actually have your book, your textile manual, your dyeing manual. I took it without permission. I thought I had permission. I didn't have permission. Whatever it was your book. That's a simple case of nana. I actually read your book. The cases of the Nodeb Yehuda and the Divrei Malkiel are much less clear. The case of Nodeb Yehuda, as we'll see, involves a customer who commissioned a printing job. And the printer, in those days, before they had computers, printing meant you took actual physical movable type, you put it in a frame, and then use that to print. So the printer, after he had a frame full of type, he wanted to take that frame and print books of his own, using the same, it was a Gemara, he wanted to take the same frame, the same type, it was ready here, it's free typesetting, and use it to print a competing edition of the Shas. So the Yehuda discusses whether the customer is entitled to that printing, because he paid for it, that typesetting, and the printer, he discusses, is being nana from the work that the customer paid for. So that's what the Nodeb Yehuda, and the Nodeb Yehuda concludes, and that's called nana v'chaser, because the customer is losing, because he's losing, people are going to be competing against his shas that he paid for. It was a vanity publishing arrangement. He paid to have a shas printed with his own commentary on it, and now the printer prints his own cheap shas without a commentary. That's definitely chaser, and it's nana, because the customer is entitled to that, those plates, those typesetting. So mele, it's called nana v'chaser. Baruch Tum and Frankel, however, not on the sheet, but Baruch Tum and Frankel, it says, you don't know what Nodeb Yehuda is talking about, he says. That's nana, the customer owns something here? He says, yes, the customer paid for it. But it's not his, the type, the frames, they all belong to the printer. The customer doesn't take it home. The printer, at the end of the day, is going to break it down and reuse it. The customer doesn't own anything here. So he says, it's not at all pashut, you can call that nana from the property of someone else. Divrei Malkiel's case also was a much, not at all an obvious case of nana. Divrei Malkiel's case was someone was manufacturing, did research, development, manufacturing, distribution, of some kind of fragrant water, Mayim Mesukim Umerichim. And he got a permit from the Warsaw Health Ministry. I'm not sure if the permit was for safety, for efficacy, I don't know if it was made claims about health, whatever it was, he spent a lot of money getting this permit. Someone else made a knockoff and produced the same formula and stuck the label saying Warsaw Health Ministry permit number 45, whatever the number was, on the labels and was competing. So obviously there was competition, so obviously it's chaser. He also takes for granted that cutting into sales is chaser. But also, the question about nana. So he also discusses the idea that you're nana for my work. But again, you're not nana for my physical object. I didn't take your actual labels. I didn't take your actual water. I copied the idea, the same formula, the same idea, and I'm selling it. So it's not so obvious that would be called nana, but he seems to feel also that if you're nana for my labor, if you're nana from my investment of time, of research, of effort, that also is called nana. He also invokes the doctrine of shutfus, that since you decided to go into this business, you're producing the same water, you have this involuntary shutfus idea, we both need the permit now, so you certainly have to pay, he says, your fair share of the permit as a form of shutfus also. And that's something hopefully shutfus and the intersection between shutfus and nana is something we'll return to later in the week.